Good morning and happy 2014. You're listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. I'm Kushlani D'Souza, and today we're taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from 2013. You'll hear Sarika Mehta's story about filmmaker Vidyut Latte's documentary on the deaf and hard of hearing community in Mumbai. We'll also feature Sarika's conversation with historian Joe Ogden about Astoria's Punjabi community at the turn of the 20th century. Today's program also includes an excerpt of my March discussion about gendered violence and social movements in India with Smith College professor and activist Pinky Hota. Andrew Yeh tells the story of a Japanese-American veteran's Congressional Medal of Honor. And Ka Her interviews local activist Tui Tran about Asian Americans' political involvement. We'll end the show with a remembrance of Afifa Ahmed Shafi, a longtime friend and APA Compass founding member. First, let's listen to Luann Algoso's conversation with comedian activist Jenny Yang, who's made headlines recently for her viral hashtag NotYourAsianSidekick Twitter campaign. She talked to APA Compass in May about her disoriented comedy tour.
Oh my God, you guys, I'm so excited to be here! So excited! I hung out in Portland for a week, and I swear to God, I need to not feel the pressure of peers because I really want to get a tattoo. So this is what I decided. I want to get a tattoo. It's going to be two words. It's going to be all capitals, and it's going to say Chinese tattoo.
My name is Luann Algoso, and you're listening to APA Compass. Today, we're speaking with Los Angeles-based writer and comedian Jenny Yang. One of her biggest projects to date is her co-founding the first ever all-female Asian-American stand-up comedy tour, Disoriented.
Yeah.
Welcome, and thank you for coming on the show today, Jenny.
Thank you.
So, tell us about how you started in stand-up.
How did I start in stand-up? Well, I've written all my life, tortured youth poetry. And then I performed it in college when I realized people performed their poetry. And I was surrounded by an awesome community of student of color activists. And then when I graduated college from Swarthmore College, I found an amazing space in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles called Tuesday Night Project or Tuesday Night Cafe, and which is an amazing network of Asian American artists who twice a month for like over 14 years have been doing this free multidisciplinary sort of performance space at open mics. So through that, I really was nurtured to perform. Over the years, people would just say, oh, yeah, you're like a comedian. And finally, I made a bucket list because, you know, you're only young
one night
at a slumber party. One still does that sometimes. A friend of mine, after I was telling a story that everyone was laughing at, she was like, hey, Jenny, you're like a comedian.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I heard this before, but I'm actually going to be open to hearing it this time. Right now, I will declare that I'm going to, you know, do an open mic stand-up set before my next birthday. That's what happened. And from there, after wanting to throw up, after doing it, and it felt horrible, and I probably did all the sort of first-timer hack jokes, potty humor. Because of that, I still kind of thought, wow, like, this was really scary, and I haven't been so scared in so long. I probably could grow from this, so let me do it more, because I'm a glutton for punishment. So, yeah, that's how I got going. And, I've been doing it ever since, pretty consistently.
So what would you say is the kind of comedy, then, do you perform?
Let's see. It's tough because I've only been doing it for maybe 4 years now, while pretty much most of the time working a full-time job. So I think most comics would say that 7 to 10 years is when you really find your voice. But I'm pretty sure that I am always going to think the way I think, which is a lot about race and social justice issues.
Right.
And just about identity and family. So, and just silly things like tapioca milk tea and the alternate life that I'd never lived as a rapper. So that's
So
I think a lot about race, and I talk a lot about being Asian American, being woman. So I talk mostly about race, I would say, and identity.
And so what do you like most about being an Asian American comedian, and what would you say that you like the least?
I think what's tough is that Asian Americans are still very invisible in most entertainment arenas. So most public arenas, Asian Americans are invisible. I think little things will pop up in the sort of public eye, like Margaret Cho or Long Duk Dong or Psy or William Hung, She Bangs, which is really all just variations on a theme. So, and I feel like there's still a lack of kind of... I don't know how to put it. There's a lack of understanding of Asian Americans as being multifaceted and full human beings. And so I think the positive part about being Asian American as a stand-up comedian is that I'm very proud of being Asian American and an immigrant. And I like to talk about it because it's a big part of who I am. It is who I am. And therefore, my comedy will talk about it. And the negative, the sort of downside of doing stand-up and talking about being Asian American is that not a lot of people do it. I think, you know, in a general comedy space, if it's not like an Asian American community space, there's usually a very basic threshold of understanding that most of the audience members need to have in order to understand maybe some of my stories or my perspective. And so I found myself, you know, I took my share of sort of ethnic studies or Asian American studies classes as an undergraduate. And I think approaching doing stand-up, I realized, wow, like, if I want to talk about things, I really have to get very clear about, you know, my opinions about being Asian American, because it's almost like, how do you make things funny but also understandable for a general audience who might not have taken Asian American Studies 101?
Right.
You know, so it's little things like we're diverse. You know, it's like a weird label that we're Asian, or I'm not going to make math jokes, even though I'm really good at math.
Right.
You know, but I do refer to it. You know, it's tough because on the one hand, I am kind of a model minority, which is, you know, what most Asian Americanists would say is bad because it hides, you know, some truths in our community. And so on the one hand, I can fulfill that stereotype. And on the other hand, I'm doing stand-up comedy, which really doesn't fulfill that stereotype.
Yeah. How do you measure good comedy?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways that, like, people will laugh. Everyone can laugh at a lot of things. But what I believe is good humor, in my capital C definition, is stand-up comedy and humor in that arena is best when you are not bullying those who already get bullied. That's that's my preference for what good comedy is. If you're really good at making fun of people that most people make fun of already, that's not that hard, you know? And oftentimes Asian Americans are on the one of the lowest on the totem poles when it comes to that. So for me, I believe good comedy is the ability to make fun of those who are in positions of power rather than those who are often disempowered. So, and that makes it harder. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like, how do you talk back to the bully and make it funny and awesome? And I feel like a lot of people who get into stand-up comedy tend to be people who, you know, maybe felt voiceless or maybe were the ones who were beat up or whatever.
Jenny Yang is the co-founder for the Disoriented Stand-Up Comedy Tour. For more information about the Disoriented Stand-Up Comedy Tour, check out disorientedcomedy.com. This is Luann Alvosa for APA Compass.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the annual APA Compass show, where we take a look back at some of our favorite stories of the past year. Hear the full version of Jenny Yang interview that just aired and other stories at our archives on www.kboo.fm/APA Compass. Coming up next, we'll pick up partway through Sarika Mehta's conversation with filmmaker Vidyutlate about her documentary Beyond Silence.
I wanted to go back to something you said at one of the schools, that they were talking about the benefit of hearing people. Maybe expand on what that means for our listeners who haven't yet seen your movie.
Yeah. So during my research and when I was shooting with at one of the schools, it was a deaf school, and I mean the people over there really were very welcoming, and they wanted to enforce what their side of thinking is, because I was trying to tell them what the deaf people feel. The deaf people typically feel that none of the deaf students who go to deaf school are really educated. They just cram the stuff, whatever, you know, lessons they are asked to learn every day. They just cram. They just try to, you know, just put it out there during examinations, and that's it. If they pass, that's it. They are promoted to, you know, the next level. Most of the students lose interest because they don't really get interested in the topic. If they use sign language, they'll be taught better. The deaf schools mostly don't use those tactics. They mostly emphasize only on oral communication. And the reason they say is that it's for the benefit of hearing people, because obviously the majority of the people around are hearing. And it is, in a way, a deficiency. You know, it is kind of something that deaf people lack in themselves, and hearing people are here to empower them by teaching them oral method, communicating in spoken languages. And that's what deaf schools are actually doing in India. And they believe that that is the only way you can educate deaf students. But deaf students and deaf activists have, you know, shared with me that that is not the right way to teach them. The best way is sign language and maybe bilingualism. That is the best way. You know, you can learn it. But the emphasis has to be on sign language, and that is not happening there.
This also brings up the point that India is super multilingual, and especially in a city like Bombay where your movie is shot. So we're talking about lip reading, and I know people code switch a lot across a variety of languages. For me, it begs the question how somebody can lip read across five languages, exactly, for one thing, and then be expected to achieve this with any grain of success. And also, with India having such pride in the many languages, or why is sign language in India not included in that pride?
There's not much awareness about it. That's the first thing. I mean, I have seen incidences while I was growing up there. If you see somebody signing, you know, at the railway station or at any public place, people used to ridicule that. You know, they were like, oh, who are these people and why are they signing? You know, there's just no awareness that this is a language, like all other spoken languages in the world. This is one of the languages that we need to accept. And there are people who use that language to communicate in their everyday life. And they're absolutely fine with it. You know, they have learned it. And there are hearing people now, like yourself, you know, who are learning it to become trained interpreters. I mean, there are linguists, you know, who have been studying this language for years now, you know. It's just that India right now, I mean, maybe things have changed in the past 3-4 years, but still now I would say there is not much awareness. I didn't feel, well, I was growing up. I'm talking about and sharing something while I was growing up there. You know, I lived there for like 20 or 29 years of my life, but there was not much awareness about it. Mostly, I would say the language is interpreted as gestures. There's a big difference between gestures and a language. I don't want to be judgmental only about Indian people, but probably where there is not much awareness about sign language, they probably interpret it as, oh, it's a language about gestures. These things are not true. I mean, people are educating themselves to have a bachelor's and master's and PhDs in sign language linguistics. We are talking about something really far away. But at this moment, why sign language and acceptance for the deaf life or deaf culture is not there, I think primarily is because of lack of awareness. Lack of awareness of the fact that there is a life that this community has imbibed, and they are very happy about having it, and they have a language. The larger hearing community need to accept that.
So speaking of this awareness, tell us about your experiences while you were filming. You had mentioned that you felt that you were the one impaired when you were in the deaf community.
Oh yeah, that was, I think, one of the most fascinating experiences of my life, where I, being a hearing person myself, you know, it kind of just hit me that how it is easy for us to just address somebody as, oh, maybe he or she is handicapped, or maybe, you know, he or she belongs to the disability, you know, group. Because one of the deaf persons in my documentary, he pointed out that in one of the conversations, and I've shot this in the documentary, he said, when a hearing person comes into our community, he or she is handicapped. So being handicapped is just a label. So if the hearing world calls me handicapped, it's fine. But when you come into my community, you are also handicapped. And of course, he was absolutely 100% right, because when I went to their community, I was there for like 3-4 months just shooting with them and trying to talk to them rather. And in one of the conversations, I was trying to have this conversation with one of the deaf persons where, you know, we were trying to schedule an interview. And he was talking to the interpreter, and the interpreter and this deaf person, they were constantly communicating, and I was just left like an outsider there. I kept just looking at their faces, not knowing what they were talking about. And they were talking about the documentary. They were talking about scheduling the interview. And I myself was like totally oblivious to what they were talking. And I said, wow, I'm handicapped here. And they're so right about it. So it's about different perspective. You know, it's about having a different perspective, a different aspect of life that I got to know about it. And I hope when people watch this document, they also get to know about it.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass's New Year's show. I'm Kushlani D'Souza. Up next, we're featuring an excerpt from my interview last March with Smith College professor Pinky Hota. We discussed the media coverage of the highly publicized rape of a young woman in Delhi and the complicated messages the media sends about race, nationality, and violence. Listeners, please note that this 7-minute excerpt might be triggering for survivors of violence or their advocates. Asked Professor Hota about recent headlines that suggested that outrage over the incident would, quote, drag India into the 21st century.
I think, unfortunately, that there has been a general impulse in which even the most culturally sensitive publications have portrayed this problem as a sign of the inherent violent nature of South Asia and a sign of its barriers to achieving modernity, and the way that South Asia is consistently figured as still engaging in barbaric practices. But this kind of reportage is actually in keeping with a long tradition, a longer history in which women's issues have long provided the entry point for outside criticism, be it colonial cultures or Western human rights discourses. This is a function of how a kind of us and them thinking that extends across two levels. One is the international arena versus India, and then even within India, urban population versus a rural population. In the international arena, this us and them thinking promotes headlines like these that say, well, violence against women is a South Asian problem rather than a global problem. This preserves an idea of the West as somehow not engaging in violence against women and more benevolent, and that gendered violence is not as much a Western problem as it is a South Asian problem. There, too, the us and them thinking exempts people from examining their own selves and displacing the problem onto the other.
We've been talking about how not to suggest that violence is not an Indian cultural problem. But on the other hand, some critics have pointed out that some media sources are minimizing the problem of rape in India by making these exact comparisons. I was reading British blogger Sunny Hundle, who criticized a liberal Guardian newspaper for manipulating statistics to suggest that reporting rates of rape and conviction rates in rape cases in India are on par with Britain's, when in fact they are considerably lower. And he says, you know, this is patronizing. It's this attitude of it's just as bad in the West is actually unfair in ways to the Indian women who are protesting rape culture that's specific to India.
I absolutely agree, because there is a fine line to be tread here. On the one hand, one wants to contemplate gendered violence as a global problem. On the other hand, it would be equally analytically lazy and inaccurate to say that there is nothing about this that is being perpetuated by particular Indian attitudes towards women or culturally salient practices. So in some sense, what I've encouraged my students to do is both to kind of attend to the particulars, but also continue to think about what are the kind of larger global parallels to be drawn here.
One of the things that I noticed in some of the international media coverage of this case is sometimes the opposite of victim blaming. There's this desire to discuss all of her positive characteristics. She was a student. She was working to help support her family. And those things are true. But sometimes I wonder if, while I'm glad that we're not victim blaming, if the Western media, if they're really trying to tell us, but she wasn't bad, right? She didn't deserve this. Unlike, you know, someone who might be not a student or lazy or something.
That's a great point, and that was yet another thing that came up, where students really wanted to know, why is it that there was so much elaboration of the fact that she was a very driven student, that she wanted to bring her family out of poverty, and that, you know, in some ways she was a model of India's neoliberal aspirations, where individual achievement and hard work and education was people's ticket out of grinding poverty. And this was a kind of thwarting of that dream. Also, there have been other disturbing developments in India which make you think about who really matters to the nation and who matters in terms of who we come to care about and who we feel more for or who we feel at all for. Because when I was in India a few months ago, people would often take out their smartphones or their computers and show me a picture of the alleged victim and a kind of picture of her smiling and a picture of her in bandages in the hospital. But I soon realized that those pictures were not of the victim at all. And the reason that this was particularly disturbing was that this girl in the picture was light-skinned, good-looking, had the distinct aesthetics of a middle-class, attractive girl. And there was a sense that was the figure that could marshal the most sympathy. That was the figure that we could care about. But actually, the real victim perhaps was not, you know, a middle-class, light-skinned, upper-caste person, but was perhaps, in fact, darker-skinned. But it was this idea of how to construct a figure that would elicit sympathy, and in how that revealed who we care about and what counts as a person worthy of being cared about in the Indian nation. And so, yes, we did come to, this is very much, like you pointed out, the opposite of victim blaming. It was kind of constructing a kind of false figure of the victim, which we could find most of feeling for in some sense.
Now, this is something that we do in the United States all the time. One example that jumps into my mind is the media coverage of the horrific Newtown shooting, which got so much attention. The faces of those white middle-class children represent a group that in America is identified as inherently good. We saw in their heartbreaking school photos the representation of, as you say, bodies that matter. But the faces of dozens of African-American young people who have been killed in an epidemic of gun violence in Chicago, these victims haven't elicited the same kind of national outcry.
Exactly.
Now that the trial is underway for five of the men accused in this Delhi rape incident, I wonder, what do you see or hope for in the wake of the trial?
This has been a moment, unfortunately, of great sadness, but this is a moment in which men are accountable for the kinds of masculinities they have been inhabiting. This is a moment in which governments are being called into question by women. This is a moment in which women's issues may actually get exposed to a much wider public. So I would like for people to consider that this moment has political possibilities.
Well, Pinky Hota, thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, APA Compass's New Year's show is taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from 2013. You just heard an interview with Professor Pinky Hota on Western media coverage of sexual violence in India, and now you'll hear about the Congressional Medal of Honor for Japanese American soldiers in World War II.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
General George Marshall was asked early in World War II if America had a secret weapon that would ensure victory in the war. And Marshall responded by saying, yes, America does have a secret weapon. It's the best darn kids in the world. We gather today to remember and pay tribute to some of those best darn kids. Remarkable and courageous heroes who were members of the 100th Infantry Battalion, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and the Military Intelligence Service. These best darn kids were willing to fight and die for their country, despite the fact that their country and many of their countrymen did not treat them with justice, fairness, or respect.
And to the Republic for which it stands.
These men fought for the freedom of others while their own rights and those of their families were being denied. They served this country as it held their own family and friends. Such is their remarkable example of dedication, unwavering loyalty, and patriotism beyond compare.
One nation, under God, indivisible.
The Congressional Gold Medal, which if you have not already seen it, absolutely take advantage of this day to do so, is the highest civilian honor. But in keeping with the humility for which the Nisei are so well known, it fits into the palm of one's hand. Notwithstanding its small size, it carries a history of enormous consequence. It represents the very essence of freedom in America, and it is a touchstone to service and sacrifice and loyalty and courage and honor and patriotism that exemplifies the Nisei contributions to this nation.
A few friends were asking me about the day, and I told them that the Go for Broke regiment was finally going to be recognized. And one of them said, "It's about time." And I think we all understand that's not quite right. It's not just about time. It is way, way, way past time. And let us make sure that this community understands how much we appreciate these courageous soldiers today.
You heard the voices of Kerry Timchook, Lynn Fujigami Longfellow, Anna Cohn, and Senator Ron Wyden at a celebration in Portland, Oregon with local Japanese-American Nisei soldiers who served in World War II and who were collectively awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. These American soldiers of Japanese descent fought with high distinction and record-setting decoration counts. Ironically, many of the soldiers' families were placed in internment camps during World War II in an act of government racism justified by war hysteria. Unfortunately, the racism persisted after the end of the war, with many Nikkei families unable to reclaim their property and reestablish themselves in their former neighborhoods. In an attempt to right the wrongs of the past, the government apologized and paid nominal reparations 40 years after the war, and awarded the Congressional Gold Medal 60 years later. I had the pleasure of speaking with several of the veterans. Roy Matsumoto served as a Japanese language intelligence specialist with Merrill's Marauders in the Burma campaign. Merrill's Marauders became famous for their deep penetration missions behind Japanese lines, frequently facing Japanese forces greater than their own. Matsumoto was essential to the Marauders' success. While his battalion was trapped in Napumga, Matsumoto crawled away every night to the Japanese lines to overhear their plans and played a critical role in the subsequent battle. He tells us what happened.
What did you serve in during World War II?
In Burma. It was the Merrill's Marauders.
And what was your role there?
I went to language school and graduated, assigned to General Stilwell's army, and General Merrill invaded Burma, and I accompanied them.
So you were a translator then?
Yes, translator, interrogator, investigator, mm-hmm. all kind of intelligence work.
So I understand it was difficult being a Japanese-American serving in the Pacific Theater.
Right.
Because there was always worries that you'd be mistaken.
Yeah, sure, that's right. They're the danger. Mm-hmm. Yes, and then pretty hard to tell from Vietnamese or natives and Japanese and Chinese, see? All mixed up there. So, well, of course, we're being protected, but pretty dangerous situation.
Do you have any favorite memories from that time?
Well, what happened was a place called Wallabomb. and we encountered enemy communication line, and I tapped in, and they got the information what their plan were.
I see that.
So we are able to survive ourselves, and also after that, we know what their plan were. Then Fresco Napunga, we've been surrounded for 10 days, no place to go, but I risked my life to find out what the enemy plan was. And one night, I find out the enemy gonna attack following morning, dawn attack. So we came back and we evacuated foxhole and booby trap, and they set up another fire line and waited. Sure enough, they came, and they attacked foxhole and bayonet and everything. We weren't there. So they thought maybe we're up there. Then we waited up a little up above. Then they came to about 15 yards. We opened up, commenced fire. Then went more than down. Then reinforcement, the troops coming up there. And they saw the commotion there, just like a Chinese, you know, New Year. So all get excited. They heard that the first group would be wiped out. So they tried to retreat. I gave them order to attack order. I gave my Japanese order, said, Totsugeki ne, you know, tokan tsukame. They thought I was a Japanese officer in charge. So follow my order and go up there and open up again. Then about 30 minutes after daybreak, we found the 54 dead ones, no wounded ones, no prisoners. And outside, nobody got the scratch. 54, you know, enemy dead. I received a Legion of Merit for saving a 2 battalion. And nobody got hurt. And I myself survived. I'm still here. And I am 3 months older than 100 years. So I'm greatly honored.
For his heroics, Matsumoto earned the Bronze Star, the Legion of Merit, and of course the Congressional Gold Medal. He was inducted into the Ranger Hall of Fame and the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame, and has the distinction of being the only person inducted into 2 Halls of Fame. More details about Matsumoto and his amazing story can be found in the documentary, Honor and Sacrifice, The Roy Matsumoto Story. Many thanks to the Oregon Nikkei Endowment, the Oregon Historical Society, and the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Service for bringing the Congressional Gold Medal and these Japanese-American veterans together in Portland. Thanks to Shig Imai and Roy Matsumoto for sharing their stories with us. Nola Bogle sang the Star-Spangled Banner. I'm Andrew Yeh for APA Compass.
On the line.
Coming up next, Sarika Mehta talks with historian Joe Ogden about Astoria's Punjabi community at the turn of the 20th century. Remember that you can hear full versions of these and other stories at www.kboo.fm/APA Compass.
Talking about history and archiving records, you mentioned the scholar says there's what happened and what is said to have happened.
Yes.
And I find this really interesting in the work of historians. How do you reconcile these two accounts?
Well, because I think ultimately it comes down to humans are just storytelling machines. That's what we are, right? I mean, and as much as histories sometimes like to claim about its objective and just the facts, ma'am, it's, you know, I don't buy it. And a lot of other historians don't buy it either. You know, more importantly, a lot of other historians. And, you know, history isn't just a list of facts. We don't just make lists. We put them together into a story. And there's no time that we can step outside of our beliefs. So our beliefs and our thinking stitches together those facts. And that's what I think this Trujillo, the Haitian historian, has so brilliantly talked about, and I really encourage people to read his work, is, you know, when it gets interesting is when you start looking at that difference between what happened and what we say happened, because that's where it gets juicy and dicey, and you actually start learning some things, you know, which was his point.
How did you collect your research for this?
Yeah, because there's no continuous community, or I shouldn't say that. It's extraordinarily scant. There are a couple of descendants that I know, and I have spoken to people, but for the most part, it's a disconnected community between people who came here later, the 80s, 90s, et cetera, right? So mainly what I did was, you know, for me, history is just like a big scavenger hunt for adults, right? And this one in particular, I just sort of took a comb to the records from Astoria to the Dalles. So I went through pretty much in every town, and I learned some things about communities I didn't even know existed, like one south of Hood River called Winans that is basically a whistle stop out in the woods, and had a meeting of 100 men for the gutter party to organize for it, which is just, if you ever go out there, it was kind of mind-boggling to think about, because they were basically sitting out in the woods and planning to overthrow the British. So it's a crazy story, right? I mean, They literally, these people were, you know, they collected money, they put out a paper, they were going to rent a boat, fill it up with guns, drive it home, and overthrow the British while they were occupied with the Germans during World War I. That was, gutter means mutiny. It also means revolution. It translates both ways. And a lot of the mutiny part refers to the fact that a lot of these men were ex-military men, because the Sikhs were a very predominant part of the British colonial, both military force and police force.
Well, what I was getting to was that to kind of write the history of someone else's community is a very careful and sensitive thing to take on. So what are some of the challenges that you faced?
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing, I would have voted me least likely to write this history. But sometimes you just find yourself doing something. So then you're either faced with a choice of not doing it because you're not of that community, or just trying to do the best job that you can with it. And I had a lot of people help me so that I, you know, both members of that community today, scholars from that community, people that aren't South Asian but are also scholars of that community. So I sought out a lot of help. And you know, you just, and I vetted it a lot. That's the other thing, amongst people. So, you know, and I'd love to make this a more collective project, and I have some thoughts about doing that, and I'm talking to people about doing that. Besides in general, that I think history is better when it's done that way, is that I think this history belongs to a community. So that's where it should go.
In a complicated story that has, until now, been unaccounted for, what does it mean to belong?
Yeah. So what does it mean, for example? I mean, I guess the words that sort of echo in my head a lot these days are, go home. Like, what the hell? What does that mean? Go home. And it doesn't reflect the complexity of, or the complexion, if you want to get that down to it, of what this area, what North America has been from the get-go. You know, first from the indigenous peoples, then, you know, you're talking about African chattel slaves, you're talking about massive labor from every single part of the world. And especially in the West, you have to talk about the peoples from China, Hindustan, Japan, the Philippines. That is part and parcel of why this place looks like it does today. And we need to complicate our stories much more than the narration that goes.
Good morning. This is APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show. Our annual New Year's program takes a look back at some of our favorites from last year. And coming up next, Kahur interviews local activist Tui Tran about APA political involvement. We'll wrap up our show with a community calendar, as well as a remembrance of Afifa Ahmed Shafi, a longtime friend and founding member of the APA Compass Collective.
The very first thing that struck me about Dr. Tui Tran is her warmth. I met her in February 2011 inside the Capitol in Salem, and I'm so honored to introduce Dr. Tui Tran.
Hi, Ka.
Hi. It's so great to have you.
Hi, APA Compass.
It's so great to have you here in this room and share this energy. So thank you for being part of my first show. So can you share a little bit with me about roles and occupation?
Currently, I am an optometric physician at Rose City Vision Care. I'm active in the community there. I'm a member of the Portland Hollywood Lions Club, a community service organization in the Hollywood District. Currently, my main role is as a mother of three. I have three children. Lucas is my oldest. He's 12 years old. Oscar is my second. He's 10. And Vera, my precious daughter, is 8. And it is because of them that I ran for state representative of House District 47. And again, it was because of them and all the children of the neighborhoods that I live in that I ran for the Park Row School District Board.
So recently, you became Park Row School District Board, and you're currently also in the Air National Guard.
Yes, correct? I'm a lieutenant in the Portland Air National Guard. I participate with the 142nd Medical Group.
Have you share with us, if you could please walk us through how you began your journey as a candidate for Democratic House District 47, and what propelled you to enter?
The reason why I ran for state representative of House District 47 was because one of my friends asked me. Mm-hmm. I was already in a mindset of wanting to do something for my community. And when my friend Joseph Santos Lyons asked, "Hey, Tui, would you consider running for state representative of House District 47? I asked him, "Oh, what's all involved? What do I have to do? And how, as a legislature, I can affect my community." At that time, when Joseph approached me, I was an upset and frustrated mom, because what happened was Halloween of 2011, it was a Monday, and I was volunteering in my children's classroom, my daughter's class, at Russell Academy in the Park Row School District. She was a first grader. Miss Katie, one of the teaching assistants there, gave Vera, my daughter, and all her classmates lollipop. So after the volunteering day was done and I was leaving the parking lot, I rolled down the window as I was in there and asked Vera to thank Miss Katie. And I asked Miss Katie, "Hey, Miss Katie, what are you going to be for Halloween?" And Miss Katie said, "Tui, I'm not going to be anything because I have to go to a school board. They're cutting another 5 school days from our children." And one thing led to another, and she said, "Tui, why don't you go?" So I went home, and I asked my children, "Hey, children, you want me to stay home, pass out candies for your friends, or you want Mama to go to a school board meeting and try to fight for 5 school days?" And bless my children, they said, "Go, Mom." And so that night when I went, I asked the school board to consider not cutting the budget, not cutting 5 school days. However, the school board members said their hands were tied and that it was state fundings that mm-hmm. is limiting them, that is causing them to have to balance their budget by cutting school days. And so I was very deflated mm-hmm. and felt very helpless. So when Joseph asked me, "Tui, would you consider that?" I'm thinking, if the school board can't do it and they need money from the state, maybe I should go to the state. and strive to protect my children and the children of the Park Row School District that way. So that's how it all got started.
That's how it all got started. Wow. Can you go in more in depth about the significant education to you? Like, what excites you when it comes to education, despite the school funding and budget cuts?
Well, I'm a product of the public school system. My parents came with the United States in 1975. My sibling and I, two brothers, two sisters, mom and dad, with nothing. When we were came to the United States as refugees from the Vietnam War. So if we did not have a fabulous public school system here in the United States, I wouldn't be able to become an eye doctor. I wouldn't be able to have my own business. I wouldn't be able to serve my community. I wouldn't even be able to do what I do now for the Air National Guard as their chief of optometry. Mm-hmm. So I firmly believe that all children in the United States, as well as anywhere, should deserve the best education possible. So it really saddens me that as taxpayer, as parents, as community member, we entrust the school system and the state to provide education for our children, yet because budget issue, our children's school days are cut and cut and cut, not just school days, but other program like athletics and funding for TAG, Talented and Gifted Program, as well as other programs too.
So in terms of your campaign and the creation process, what would you have done differently now that you've been through it?
I always wish I could work a little harder because I think I miss a win for the state legislature, House District 47, in the 2012 primary by 355 votes. So maybe more time, work a little harder, knock on more doors. Maybe I could have
So it was a pretty close race.
It was a pretty close race.
By how many votes, you said?
355 about.
Wow. It's amazing.
Yeah, so every single vote does matter. Yeah. So all those people who forgot to turn in their ballot, I needed you.
So through your campaign, you were a part of many memorable events. Can you share a little bit about the Democratic National Convention that you were part of, the experience?
Many times as a citizen, we complain about this and we complain about that. But I, through my journey, realized that we can make a lot of difference, but we have to participate. I didn't know that as a regular person, I can participate in processes that allow me to be at the Democratic National Convention and cast a vote to re-elect our president. It was just never in my wildest dream to be at an event like that. But at that event, I saw the energy and the love that people have for our country.
Where was this national event?
It was in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. So this leads to my next question. How do you encourage us to experience failure? And how often do we get up and try again?
All the time. But one thing that I always have to remind myself is to not give up. Just because you don't get the result that you want, that doesn't really mean that you fail. It just means not yet. Let's fine-tune your process, get some more knowledge, get some more mentoring, and try again. And running for the Park Row School District Board was my try again. And I am able to take from what I've learned during my 2012 primary campaign and apply it to the Park Row School District Board run. And luckily, or with more help from my friends and family and the community, I was able to win the election this May of 2013, this year.
Yeah, great. So any new co-founded activities that you would like for us to look forward to? The API caucus.
Well, right now I'm organizing an Asian American Pacific Islander caucus for the Democratic Party of Oregon. Mm-hmm. So any Asian American Pacific Islander out there, if you want to get involved more with the Democratic Party or just to add your voice to a body that can carry that message onward to the state level and then to the national level, please give us a call, and we'll gladly listen.
Lisa, thank you so much for giving me your time, and I just want to congratulate you on your recent achievement. Thank you for carrying aspiration and hope into the community. Thank you for being on the decision table to help make meaningful decisions for our future generation ahead. And again, thank you for your time. It's been such an honor, Doctor. So this concludes our chat.
Okay.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everyone.
This is Afifa Ahmed Shafi reporting for APA Compass.
In May 2005, APA Compass, a collective of Asian, South Asian, and Pacific American community organizers, advocates, and activists, produced our first public affairs program for KBOO Community Radio. While most of us had a steep learning curve around what it took to produce and engineer a radio program, Afifa was there to help steady the nerves. Going into our first program, the run sheet was a nightmare. For anyone who has engineered an hour-long radio program, you know a two-page run sheet is just, well, complete chaos. I remember Afifa's reaction to the run sheet. She smiled, took a deep breath, maybe even two, and was ready to go. In addition to being the program's master engineer, Afifa also contributed to the program, sharing her thoughts, feelings, and knowledge on air. Here's a soundbite from the piece that aired in 2011 after the death of Osama bin Laden.
Do you think bin Laden's death will translate into greater acceptance and less stereotyping of the Muslim community and Islam here in the U.S.?
I wish that could be true, but unfortunately, I don't think it's a clean break from the stereotyping that we've been experiencing over the last 10 years. Unfortunately, there's a lot more work to do, and in terms of how to do that, I think Muna talked about a lot of successful methods. I think, you know, the struggle continues, and it has to do with our foreign policy. It has to do with you know, the perceptions of Muslim Americans around the world. So unfortunately, not necessarily.
You know, we used to talk about living in a post 9/11 world, and now we're in a post bin Laden world. So in your opinions, ladies, what comes next?
I mean, one item if people aren't thinking about already in terms of, you know, pausing to reflect on who bin Laden was and how he got his start and how that relates to U.S. foreign policy and looking back at what U.S. government's role was in that. It's a sobering reality. But I think it's really important that as U.S. citizens, Americans, we really take note of how we got to where we are today and what led to it and what responsibility we had in the matter.
In a panel discussion with other collective members, Afifa talked about her identity as a South Asian.
My name is Afifa. It definitely depends on like who's asking the question and also what intention with they're asking the question. But probably most broadly, I would define myself as South Asian American. And then within that, you know, my family's from India and they're Muslim. So that's also sometimes how I describe myself, but definitely a woman of color in some contexts, person of color. But yeah, it just really depends. I guess my choice of the term South Asian is just being raised in the United States and the diaspora communities. I was, you know, I had a lot of commonality with Pakistanis and Bengalis, and we're all raised and had kind of common languages and food and cultures. And even though, you know, I know my parents were raised with kind of communities between Sikhs and Hindus, and there might be tensions, but once we're living here, we're like best friends and grew up together. So I guess I like to identify with that commonality just because the history of partition and just even the impact that had on my family's history and that my family as Indian Muslims had to resist to stay in India versus being forced to migrate to the new country, Pakistan, and just what that means to me personally and my significance. I like to relate to kind of the broader, you know, beyond just the nation, the state of India. So that's why I choose to kind of identify as South Asians. And I know, like, my parents personally don't use the term Asian even. You know, they probably say we're from India, but when it comes to time to check the box on the census form, really what's available usually is the term Asian. So that's when they find themselves checking. But I know that they often refer to, you know, their Asian coworkers and community, but what they really mean is kind of East Asians. So there is that distinction that they make.
Thank you, Afifa, not only for your contributions to APA Compass, but for all of your work and dedication towards equity and social justice. Friends and family have created an Afifa Ahmed Shafi memorial page on Facebook. In lieu of donations to her family, the family has requested folks to consider making donations in Afifa's name to the Center for Intercultural Organizing here in Portland.
It's time for another Angry Asian Minute. Here's Afifa Ahmed Shafi.
In Indonesia, in Pakistan, in India, Afghanistan, across the world, people rave about some cartoon printed in Denmark. We're thinking they're so prone to anger, so uncivilized and different from us. They don't appreciate freedom. We have freedom of press. They are so into censorship.
We are experiencing some brief technical difficulties. Stay tuned.
Across the world, people rave about some cartoon printed in Denmark. We're thinking they're so prone to anger, so uncivilized and different from us. They don't appreciate freedom. We have freedom of press. They are so into censorship. I'll tell you what. Why are we so angry? Move to riots, violence, even death? Is this about a few lines sketched on Danish newsprint? Is this really about freedom of press? Or is it just one more finger thrust deep into the wounds of our flesh? Every day, everywhere we look, occupation, invasion, you call it liberation. This is not a clash of civilizations. It is not about freedom. It is about the powerful feasting on the weak and building the structure to keep them weak. I mean, yeah, those cartoons were super racist, but that's not the issue. It's about the injustice that is perpetuating, and these folks bear the brunt. It's our tax dollars that fuel the ammunition. We install their corrupt leaders, and when we're done with them, we take them down. When you see the angry crowds in the paper and on TV, they aren't those angry people over there. Next time you see these folks, think about their grief and ask yourself, are you helping to fuel the source?
In our community this month, the History Museum of Hood River County is hosting a special event, Heroes Unheralded, to recognize local residents who stepped forward on behalf of Japanese Americans during the challenging years around World War II. Professor Linda Tamura will also be sharing stories related to her recent book, Nisei Soldiers Break Their Silence. The event is Sunday, January 12th at 2 p.m. in Hood River. For more information, please contact the History Museum of Hood River County or Linda Tamura. Next, see and hear the diary of Stanley Hayami, who was an aspiring Japanese-American writer and artist when war interrupted. Filmmaker Ann Kaneko presents a free screening of her documentary, A Flicker of Eternity, Sunday, January 12th at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society. And also, filmmaker Vu Pham explores Vietnamese and Vietnamese-American cultural identity in his short film, My Brother, which is inspired by autobiographical elements. The screening is Sunday, January 19th at 7 p.m. at the Hotel Deluxe. For more information, visit swayofthenife.com. www.bnpbrand.com.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass's New Year's program. I'm Kushlani D'Souza, wishing you a happy 2014 from all of us here at APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of every month, right here on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Become a fan of APA Compass Radio on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or email us at apacompass@gmail.com. You can download segments of this and other shows at our website, kboo.fm/apacompass. Happy New Year!
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop. From the birth of rock and roll to the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Plugged In every first and third Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight with host DJ Tronic. Tronic does a live mix in the studio featuring the latest in house, techno, tech house, breaks, dubstep, and more. Tronic also has guest DJs in the studio and often talks about upcoming parties, club nights, and more. That's Plugged In every first and third Fridays at 10 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.
And this is KBOO Portland, where the time is 10.02 a.m. Coming up is Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Coming up at 11, host Shahid Hamid hosts It Takes a Village. And at 11.30 on the Radio Zine, host Sarika Mehta interviews Mirta Ojito, a reporter who has worked for the Miami Herald and the New York Times. Her most recent work is Hunting Season, Immigration and Murder in an All-American Town. Thanks for listening to KBOO Radio, and thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, why not start the new year by becoming a member now? Just go to kboo.fm, click where it says Donate Today.
Flashpoints, did racist arsonists burn down the memorial for Andy Lopez? We'll speak to organizers and activists.